This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
It's been a big year for labor unions, so the government's labor watchdog is getting a bigger budget. Plus, artificial intelligence coming to a big rig near you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Wednesday, the 28th of December. Good to have you along. To that labor story in a moment, but first, one of the things coming up in 2023 is that Congress will start negotiating a new farm bill. It's a sweeping piece of legislation that gets an update roughly every 5 years and has a huge impact on farming economies and livelihoods. Now, the farm bill provides a financial safety net to, yes, farmers, but it also dictates how much the government spends on the social safety net, with decisions about hunger and nutrition assistance programs, and who gets to access them. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
The Farm Bill has roots in the Great Depression, when Congress signed off on what were supposed to be temporary handouts to the struggling agricultural sector.
And in the very old days, it used to be a farm bill. That is, it was about farming and agriculture and the like.
Daniel Sumner, an agricultural economist at UC Davis, says the Farm Bill still props up American ag with crop subsidies that have become a legislative fixture. But now,
about 90% of the spending and the interest in the so-called Farm Bill is food subsidies, things like food stamps.
The program now known as SNAP, plus public school lunches and the WIC nutrition program, all stretched thin in recent years, according to Vince Hall with the nonprofit Feeding America.
We are transitioning from a pandemic crisis to a hunger crisis.
His organization is pushing for big funding increases for nutrition assistance programs, and it's prepared for showdowns over who can access them. Meanwhile, tribal nations will be pushing for more control over federal food distribution in Indian country. Carly Griffith-Hotvet with the Native Farm Bill Coalition says the last bill in 2018 started an experiment, allowing tribes more flexibility in spending.
Tribes had the opportunity to source foods from local producers or tribal vendors who were producing culturally relevant and traditional food products.
This time around, the organization is looking to make that program permanent. Daniel Sumner at UC Davis says we can also expect more focus on climate and sustainability in the 2023 negotiations. So the bill covers a lot of ground.
And just about everybody has an interest in it.
He says we should all be paying attention to which programs Congress decides to support and at what cost. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Also in the new year, the federal agency that oversees labor union activity will get a budget increase. Congress approved the boost in funding for the National Labor Relations Board in the omnibus spending package passed last week. The NLRB processes union petitions, conducts union elections, makes sure collective bargaining is conducted fairly, and it investigates possible violations of federal labor law. But over the last decade or so, its resources have been stretched thinner, which labor advocates say has constrained the agency's ability to do its job. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Until this latest $25 million budget increase, funding for the National Labor Relations Board had remained unchanged for almost a decade. That's led to a 30% drop in staffing levels, says Carla Walter at the Center for American Progress.
This is particularly important in this moment in history because we're seeing that unions are more popular than they've been in decades.
Union membership has trended down since the 70s, but petitions to unionize surged by more than 50% last fiscal year as high-profile organizing efforts took off at companies like Starbucks. Unfair labor practice complaints and strike activity have also increased in recent years, says Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell's Industrial and Labor Relations School.
They have more work than they've had in decades.
And the less staff the NLRB has, she says, the longer it takes to investigate and resolve complaints.
If a worker is fired for union activity or an employer illegally locks workers out, to deal with those cases can take years.
The agency argues the delays harm workers and employers by postponing what can end up being a decision in their favor. And delays can have a chilling effect on organizing, says Harvard Law professor Sharon Block, who served on the NLRB during the Obama administration.
If the agency that's supposed to protect your rights doesn't have the resources to ensure that that happens, the result is that those rights become illusory, right? They become meaningless.
She says the increase in funding Congress approved will likely avert the predicted need for furloughs in the coming year, but it falls short of the amount the Biden administration said was needed to strengthen the agency's enforcement powers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Market's not loving tech stocks today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the end of the year comes lots of deadlines, including figuring out how to spend every last dollar in your flexible spending account, if you have one. About 43% of private sector workers and about 71% of state and local government workers do have access to FSAs, which are used to set aside pre-tax dollars for eligible medical and dental expenses. Some employers offer grace periods to spend the money after the year ends, but many have a deadline of midnight on December 31st. That means the end-of-year rush to spend the money is on, and Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on who benefits from FSAs and who's left out.
There are 3 days left in 2022, and I have $325.41 left in my FSA. So yesterday I went to FSAstore.com to see what I could get.
A no-touch forehead thermometer, a vibrating and heat foam roller, a chirp wheel. What is a chirp wheel? Does it, like, chirp at you?
For those who don't know, a chirp wheel is a roller meant to relieve back pain. There were also more traditional supplies, like Advil and Band-Aids featuring Baby Yoda. The IRS sets the parameters of what counts as a medical expense for FSA purposes. And Rachel Rouleau, the chief compliance officer for Health E-Commerce, which oversees the FSA store, says they'd like to see the IRS include more products.
For example, you can't buy most vitamins. We think that should change.
In 2020, one thing that changed was the addition of feminine hygiene products like tampons and panty liners. Nathan Fox is chief financial officer at Thinx, which sells underwear for people who deal with incontinence or are menstruating. He says Thinx now sees a spike in sales every time an FSA deadline is near, and that being FSA eligible has expanded their market.
It's gone from being, you know, a product that was more of a niche to something that is now approaching mainstream.
Still, even if the kind of items eligible for FSA dollars are expanding, lots of people are left out. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf is with the NYU School of Law and author of the book Periods Gone Public.
You have to be able to afford to put the money aside in the first place, even if you know you're not going to incur that expense for 3 months, 6 months, 1 year down the road.
Weiss-Wolf says she'd also like for FSAs to be more user-friendly so people can make changes mid-year and adjust how much they're putting in so they don't end up buying a chirp wheel if they don't need one. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
For what it's worth, Stephanie, you might be able to roll over that $325. Some employers do allow that. To to West Texas now, which has been rocked by multiple near-record earthquakes in the last few weeks. They're centered in the West Texas oil patch, but people have reported feeling them hours away in big cities. Oil field quakes have been on the rise in Texas, and state regulators say they're trying to tackle the problem. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has the story from the oil field town of Orla.
That is basically the sound of Orla. Big rigs barreling up and down the highway, hauling everything from oil and gas to water and sand. This is one of the most active parts of the Permian Basin oil patch. It's where a lot of the drilling activity has been centered in recent years. And it's also lately been a hotbed of earthquakes.
All right, thank you.
A man checks into the Armadillo Hotel in Orla, a dusty lot with rows of trailers where roughnecks sleep between shifts. Angeles Ajuntas has worked here a year and says last month's big quake was the first she's noticed. It was centered just a few miles away.
I was more shocked. I was like, I didn't think we can get them here. And so then I had my coworkers tell me, like, oh yeah, you'll get used to it. Like, you'll feel it.
This region's seen a flurry of smaller quakes over the past few years that don't always noticeably shake the ground. Robert Skomel, a seismicity expert with the U.S. Geological Survey, has studied the quakes.
2017, 2018 is when things started really ramping up exponentially.
Skomel's research has shown the vast majority of these quakes have been triggered by oil companies pumping wastewater from the drilling process into the ground. He explains how exactly it happens.
The activities are not shaking the ground. It's more changing the stresses that are acting on these faults. And those stresses, in turn, cause these faults to slip, which then cause the shaking.
Analyst firm Rystad Energy says this year alone, in the county where last month's big one happened, companies have pumped more than 49 billion gallons of wastewater into the ground.
It's an insane amount of water.
Rystad's Ryan Hassler notes that oilfield quakes aren't new. They broke out in Oklahoma at the dawn of the fracking boom, again later in North Texas. But these days in West Texas, he says, there's just a lot more wastewater that comes along with oil drilling.
You're talking about anywhere between kind of a 3-to-1 to 6-to-1 barrel of water to barrel of oil recovery in these wells. The wells have gotten a lot bigger. And so with that, we're seeing more production, but we're also seeing a lot more water production.
The response from regulators at the Texas Railroad Commission, which oversees fossil fuels, not railroads, is notably different now, too. When scientists noted the link between quakes and oil and gas less than a decade ago, regulators were initially skeptical. They've since embraced the science and even acknowledged themselves that there's a link between industry and earthquakes. Todd Staples is with the trade group Texas Oil and Gas Association.
The Railroad Commission has been significantly aggressive in curtailing activity and has led to serious financial consequences for operators in the area.
Regulators are still investigating the recent near-record quakes. In some parts of West Texas, they've shut down wastewater disposal sites. But around Orla, near the big one in November, they're mostly relying on promises and plans developed by the oil companies themselves. Staples says the industry knows more shutdowns could happen if the quakes don't slow down. But critics say officials could be more aggressive now. Virginia Palacios heads up Commission Shift, a sort of watchdog group focused on the Railroad Commission.
I think it shows that the commission is really reliant on the industry to police itself.
Regulators have outlined goals for reducing earthquakes within the next 2 years. Angeles Ajuntas at the Orla Hotel says she's not too worried about the quakes.
But it's like also concerning because you don't know what else can happen.
For now, earthquakes are just a fact of life in the oil patch. In West Texas, I'm Travis Bubenik for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a lot of truckers get into trucking because they don't want someone looking over their shoulder all the time.
No one likes a micromanager. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 365 points, 1.1%, to end at 32,875. The Nasdaq shed 139 points, 1.3%, to finish at 10,213. The S&P 500 was off 46 points, 1.2%, to close at 3783. Apple faded 3%. It's the third down day for that company. Investors are worried about the reliability of its production lines in China, given COVID outbreaks there. Energy companies slid in line with falling oil prices. Chevron was down 1.4%. ExxonMobil slipped 1.6%. Entertainment company AMC was down 4.7%. There's concern about the company's debt and worries the film industry's pandemic recovery is going slower than expected. That stock is down more than 85% this year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. It doesn't make it into the headlines here in the U.S. as often these days, but the European migrant crisis is still happening. According to the International Organization on Migration, there have been more than 180,000 migrant arrivals to Europe so far this year. Most people arrive by sea, although thousands don't survive the journey. One of the most popular routes is across the Mediterranean Sea to Italy. Just yesterday, Italy gave permission for the humanitarian ship the Ocean Viking to dock and disembark 113 migrants rescued from the sea. Previously, Italian authorities had refused to allow it, forcing the ship to sail to France. The BBC's Frey Lindsay looks at the costs of running rescue operations in the Mediterranean.
Hello!
Dozens of migrants being rescued in the Mediterranean Sea near Libya. They're trying to cross the Mediterranean to escape war, conflict, persecution, and extreme poverty. After being adrift for days, they're brought onto the 220-foot rescue vessel, the Ocean Viking, run jointly by the International Red Cross and the European humanitarian group SOS Mediterranee. This man from Mali asked we withhold his name, as he's worried speaking to us might get him in trouble with the Italian authorities.
We stay in the sea 2 days with no food, no water, no nothing, and they come save us.
This route across the central Mediterranean is one of the most common for people trying to get to Europe. By mid-November this year, around 93,000 people had tried to cross this way. Alessandro is one of the rescue workers aboard the boat. SOS Mediterranee typically withholds the last names of their crew for fear of being targeted by Italian authorities or the far right. Alessandro says finding and rescuing the migrants is hard work.
Building up a procedure for the rescue took 6 years, and we are still refining them, and mostly come from practice, because according to the books, mass emergency at sea involve more than 4 people. And we will be happy to have emergency at sea with 4 people, but normally we are in scenarios where we have 50, hundreds of people in the water.
Until 2014, Italy ran and financed its own search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean, but they stopped, citing the expense, nearly $10 million a month, and the lack of support from other EU member states. Since then, it's been left to charities that rely on a precarious network of funding. The average running costs of the Ocean Viking were around $14,000 a day, a lot of that being fuel. But with fuel prices skyrocketing, so too are costs. Sophie Bowe coordinates fundraising for SOS Mediterranee.
The cost of the fuel for our ship that has increased almost doubled in total. Our provisional budget on that particular line has increased of 86% this year.
SOS Mediterranee runs largely on private donations, and this leaves them vulnerable to external factors such as the cost of living crisis, which reduces people's ability to give, and competition with other humanitarian causes. Here's Sophie Bowe again.
A year like this year, 2022, when there is a strong pressure of humanitarian crisis, such as Ukraine, for instance, people will donate a lot for this new humanitarian crisis, and it will be more difficult for us to sustain this fundraising. This is a big worry we have.
While the high season for migrant boat crossings across the Med is over for this year, there is already concern for how the Ocean Viking and other charity ships will cope next year when crossings start to spike again. I'm the BBC's Frey Lindsay for Marketplace.
Trucking is an essential part of our economy. Our entire supply chain depends on it. According to the American Trucking Associations, when you're talking about the physical weight of stuff moving around the country, more than 72% of the nation's freight is carried on trucks. But the job can be dangerous. Long hours alone on the road, fighting weather, exhaustion, and other drivers who don't think about truck-sized blind spots. And now, trucking companies are adding more technology into the vehicles, including artificial intelligence. Karen Levy has been writing about this. She's author of the new book, Data Driven: Truckers, Technology, and the New Workplace Surveillance. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when writing about AI and surveillance and technology, why choose trucking?
Yeah, trucking is a really interesting industry through which to kind of think about and understand the way AI and surveillance are affecting work. So truckers are really the backbone of the economy, but we tend not to think about them very much. And I think not very many people have probably thought about the ways in which new digital technologies and AI are starting to affect trucking as a workplace. So that's why I wrote Data Driven.
You say in your writing that if and when AI comes more fully into the trucking world, it won't just completely replace drivers. So what will it do instead?
So autonomous vehicle technology, while it's certainly advanced quite a bit over the past few years, is nowhere close to the point where it's actually able to replace human workers. Instead, what we're seeing is that AI is being felt in trucking by actually sort of invading the cab along with the trucker. So among the things that are becoming more common in the industry are things like a camera that's trained on a driver's face that uses AI to monitor the flutter of his eyelids or how often his head is nodding. And the thinking there is that, you know, fatigue is a big problem in the trucking industry. And by using AI in camera systems or biometrics or wearables, that's a better way to, you know, potentially manage drivers and to make them operate more efficiently in the vehicle. Of course, what we actually see is that a lot of those technologies end up driving out the very safest workers and really makes the job, you know, much less tenable. So the narrative that we see is not really people getting kicked out of the cab. It's that AI is really impinging on the dignity of the job.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the truckers think about all this.
Yeah, they're not big fans. I mean, if you talk to truckers, a lot of truckers get into trucking because they don't want someone looking over their shoulder all the time. Like, that is a really common refrain among professional drivers, is that, you know, they liked the autonomy, the human autonomy that they were able to have. And a lot of new technologies that truckers are facing really, you know, are kind of an affront to that self-knowledge or that road knowledge that truckers have built up over years or even decades.
So are there short-term fixes that should be on the table to address some of these concerns that drivers actually have?
Yeah, so drivers, you know, for decades have noted that one of the biggest problems in the trucking industry is just undercompensation. In 1980, truckers made about $110,000 a year in today's dollars. And right now, they make about $47,000 annually.
Wow.
And that number has been stagnant for many years, right? It's really declined. And so what I think should happen and what truckers argue should happen is kind of changing those root causes of overwork, right? Paying people for the labor that they're actually doing, which would involve maybe changing the pay structure of trucking so that they're not paid by the mile, but are paid actually for the number of hours that they work. Other organizational issues in the industry to reduce the kind of fatigue that the technology is just being used to manage. You know, those types of solutions, they're economic, right? But the problems in trucking really are economic problems. They're not technological problems. And so trying to address them via surveillance technology, I think, will always be an inherently limited solution, right? And even a counterproductive solution. And it also drives out some of the safest workers.
What does the rollout of all this technology in the trucking industry mean for consumers?
I mean, one of the things that has been used to sort of justify some of these technologies is that, you know, consumers want safe highways. Like, I certainly want safe highways. I think you want a safe highway. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be next to a trucker who's been on the road for too long. And so, you know, these safety technologies are sometimes kind of justified on that basis. Unfortunately, what we know is that the electronic logging device and some of the other technologies that are used in trucking don't have measurable impacts on safety. They actually don't make the road safer. If anything, the evidence we have suggests that they actually make the roads less safe. Crash rates have gone up since these things became mandatory. The other thing that people sometimes talk about is, would costs go up, like for shipping, or, you know, would we have to wait longer for our Amazon Prime deliveries or something if we were actually to pay truckers for the work that they do? And the answer might be yes, but maybe those are the real social costs of, you know, depending on truckers' essential labor to do all of these things. So, you know, I think it just involves kind of a hard conversation about how much we're willing to pay to actually have safe roads and to have essential workers work with dignity and paid the wages that they deserve for that labor.
Karen Levy is author of Data Driven: Truckers, Technology, and the New Workplace Surveillance. Thank you.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, spotted in our Marketplace Daily newsletter. Country musician Zach Bryan is one of many music lovers out there furious about Ticketmaster and the effective monopoly the company has over concert ticket sales in the U.S. Bryan complained on social media that he'd met kids at his shows who were paying more than $400 for tickets and that he believes, quote, working class people should still be able to afford tickets to shows. So he's limiting the number of big headline shows he's doing in the coming year and says he'll do what he can to keep ticket prices down at those events. In the meantime, Bryan just released a new live album called, wait for it, All My Homies Hate Ticketmaster.
I came to burn Red Rocks down if you guys are here with me.
Like I said, we featured this story in the Marketplace Daily newsletter. You can subscribe by going to marketplace.org/newsletters. Here's your moment of economic context. We got pending home sales numbers from the National Association of Realtors today, and they were down 4%, the sixth month in a row of declines. Year over year, those contracts were down almost 38%. Higher mortgage rates have drastically slowed down sales, but the NAR says with rates dropping a bit this month, the industry group expects sales to pick up a bit in the new year. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kimberly Adams, and we will see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.